From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Has China's Belt and Road infrastructure project peaked? And Beijing acknowledges running internment camps for Muslims in Xinjiang province, sort of. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, broadcasting to you from News Corporation headquarters in New York City. And I am joined by my friend and colleague, fellow editorial board member Hugo Restall, who is calling in yet again from an undisclosed location somewhere out there in Asia Pacific. Who knows? Maybe he is lounging on a sunny beach in Koh Samui. Welcome back, Hugo.
Hi, Mary. It's good to talk to you again.
Okay, let's start with China's Belt and Road project. Big infrastructure project, been going for several years now, and yet it's hit a few speed bumps. What's happened, Hugo?
Well, right at the moment, Mahathir Mohamad, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, is in Beijing trying to renegotiate some of these projects and reduce Malaysia's commitment to the projects. Meanwhile, Burma, Myanmar, is also trying to reduce the size of its projects, a major port, the Kiaopiu port, which they're seeking to downsize from a $7.3 billion project to a $1.3 billion project. And as we've discussed before, in Pakistan, there's a new government as well. Imran Khan was just sworn in, and he now faces the decision of whether to downgrade Pakistan's commitment to projects that have severely added to their debt crisis. So the confluence of all these different events creates the impression that countries around the region are reconsidering the wisdom of signing up to the Belt and Road Initiative. But of course, there's still a great deal of momentum in Asia and elsewhere. So I think we're speculating a bit that this could be the peak, but it does feel like the tide is turning in terms of the sentiment towards it.
And it seems like Sri Lanka's experience was a major turning point, Hugo, and a red flag, so to speak. Sorry for the commie pun there, for many of these countries, because they were put very deeply into debt and had to turn over a project to Beijing, a port project, if memory serves. And that experience has been specifically quoted by some of these national leaders as, a warning. You don't want to go the way of Sri Lanka.
Right. So the Hambantota port complex involved about $6 billion in debt. And the port was poorly sited. It was sited in the hometown of a former strongman leader of Sri Lanka.
And, of course it was.
and an airport put right next to the port, which has also been a complete failure. Both the port and the airport have seen minimal traffic. I mean, the airport is practically deserted. And so there's no way that Sri Lanka can generate the revenue from these projects in order to service the debt. And as with many other Chinese projects, the debt was not on particularly favorable terms, in terms of the interest rate and the repayment terms. So it was almost as if it was calculated to drive the Sri Lankans into a crisis. And the outcome was that they've turned over the Hambantota port to a Chinese company on a 99-year lease, given them 70% control of the project. And the speculation is that in the long run, the Chinese may try to use the port for military purposes, give them a very convenient deep water port on the Indian Ocean from which to challenge India in particular, and to control the trade routes across the Indian Ocean to the Persian Gulf. So this is a warning to all the other countries that are accepting Chinese projects, that to look more carefully at the terms and at the sustainability of the projects and what China's long-term intentions may be.
Yeah, when you say could threaten India, I mean, it's almost an understatement, Hugo. I mean, you are an understated kind of guy, but I mean, look, you can practically stand on the northern tip of Sri Lanka and look over into India. It's that close. Hugo, the other circumstance here is, of course, you've named off three countries in Malaysia, in particular, Pakistan, in Burma, whose economies are not very strong. And Malaysia in particular, of course, just democratically overthrew the long-running UMNO grip on power. UMNO, of course, the ruling party of Malay nationalism that ran the country for decades and ran it into the ground in recent years because of corruption. Mahathir Mohamad is trying to turn that around. And I think part of that turnaround is looking at how the previous government made corrupt deals. And I think they suspect that, these Chinese deals could be wrapped up in some of those scandals. Am I right?
Right. Right. Corruption is definitely a big part of a lot of these projects. One of the reasons that China is able to get countries to sign up to these terms that are not particularly favorable to those countries is that they give a large amount of money up front, loan the money to the local leaders who are then able to use it for their own corrupt purposes. And we saw that definitely in the Malaysian case, where the UMNO government of Najib Razak was using some of this money to cover up the 1MDB scandal. That was a scandal in which a large sum of money, estimated by some to be, $4.5 billion, disappeared from a state-run investment fund. And so money was being shuffled around within the Malaysian political establishment to cover up the problems at 1MDB. And the Chinese money definitely facilitated that in terms of the Chinese buying assets and investing. So, Mahathir campaigned against this and was very outspoken. He even called it unequal treaties, which to the Chinese is, a very evocative term of the imperialist powers taking advantage of China in the early 20th century. And now he's in Beijing, and in the last day, he issued a warning against a new form of colonialism. He didn't exactly spell out what that was, but I mean, it was really quite remarkable for him to say that in Beijing.
Oh, Hugo, let's read the whole quote. It's just fantastic. This is from Bloomberg News, and quote, this is Mahathir. Quote, you don't want a situation where there's a new version of colonialism happening because poor countries are unable to compete with rich countries in terms of just open free trade. It must also be fair trade. End quote. Hugo. Now, there's a tradition in China of elder statesmen, intellectuals, speaking their mind and not suffering consequences. But to see an outsider like Mahathir come in and do this is just, I mean, it's fabulous.
Right. He is 93 years old, and, he can get away with this, I think. And in particular, I think also a lot of these countries that have so many of these projects, you get to a point where, like the old saying, you borrow $1 million from the bank and the bank controls you. You borrow $1 billion and you control the bank.
For sure.
The Chinese need now Malaysia to the projects in Malaysia to work. Otherwise, it would be a major embarrassment and derail the whole momentum of the Belt and Road Initiative.
But Hugo, it's such an opening for U.S. foreign policy if we had the wit to take advantage of it, right? Because here you have countries naturally pushing away from Beijing, recognizing what the Communist Party is trying to do, talking about a new form of colonialism. I mean, we should be all over the Asia-Pacific saying, yeah, don't turn to China. Open up your trade with us. Come do business with us.
Right. And working on infrastructure. I mean, there is a pressing need for better trade infrastructure within these fast-growing economies. And the U.S. is looking to get into that act. I mean, there's a bill in Congress now, the Build Act, which will increase funding for infrastructure lending and improve the structures that the U.S. has for that. So I think the U.S. is responding to this. The Trump administration is potentially going to take advantage of this. But right at the moment, I mean, we're playing hardball with Pakistan to try to push Imran Khan to, to publish the terms of the loans with China and, draw back on some of the projects that may not be feasible in order to get IMF bridge loan to tide them over this current crisis. So the U.S. is, I think the U.S. is mobilizing now to take advantage of China's mistakes in overreaching with the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, and we've got a great editorial, listeners. It's titled Another Belt and Road Hostage. It's up on WSJ.com/opinion if you want to take a look. We're talking about the Belt and Road Initiative, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from the Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at WSJ.com/podcasts. That's WSJ.com/podcasts. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York. Hugo Restall, somewhere out there in Asia Pacific, maybe on a beach, we don't know. We're going to stay on the topic of China because Beijing has finally admitted the existence of camps for Muslims in Xinjiang, China. But the official, He Lianhe, of the United Front Work Department, calling them, quote, vocational training centers. Hugo. When I say camp, I don't mean camp as in a tent, somewhere out in the forest. We're talking about internment camps, re-education camps, so to speak, throwbacks to the 1950s in China. But how significant is it that we finally have a party official at least saying, yes, they exist, they're there?
Right. Up until now, they've kept this as a state secret. And they've condemned those people who are trying to expose this huge human rights abuse as anti-China elements spreading lies. They're still accusing those of us who are publicizing this of being anti-China elements, but they've done a modified limited hangout, as Nixon would say, and they've admitted that there are such camps, but they're vocational schools, and nobody's being arbitrarily detained.
Yeah, when you say they, Hugo, you mean the Xi Jinping regime,
right? This is United Front Work Department is a rather mundane name for a sinister organization which is dedicated to controlling the portions of the population, the ethnic minorities in particular. These camps, we're now learning from testimony from people who have been released from the camps, use a variety of methods, including torture. I mean, they strap people down in chairs for days at a time in extremely painful positions to interrogate them. And other people, they force them to sing patriotic songs, to say that they will no longer pray. It's a very anti-religious agenda in these camps, basically telling people that the Quran is nonsense, that they were wrong to have ever believed in Islam, and they should only believe in the Communist Party and Xi Jinping, give the thanks to Xi Jinping before meals instead of giving thanks to Allah, etc. So a lot of these things are extremely outrageous anti-religious agendas that we haven't seen in China on such a scale since the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, listeners out there might be confused and think, well, but, you know, China does allow certain forms of worship, even Catholics worshiping in China. But the catch is that, of course, the CCP itself is an atheist organization. And when we talk about religion in China being allowed, quote unquote, that quote unquote religion is completely subordinated to the party. That's why it was so outrageous, for instance, when Pope Francis suggested that he could do a deal with the Communist Party to allow Catholic practice in China out in the open rather than in the underground church, because, of course, that's just not possible. You'd have to be subordinated to the Communist Party elites. It's completely antithetical to the idea of freedom of religion, right?
Right. And there's a general anti-religious campaign going on at the moment where in other parts of China, churches are being demolished, mosques are being demolished. There was, for a time, a relatively more permissive attitude towards mainstream religion. The party seemed to be moving towards a position that mainstream religions aided in social stability. Now it's a return to absolute control, and any church or mosque that is not towing the line absolutely to the party will be stamped out. So it's not just Xinjiang. I think Xinjiang is the leading edge of this campaign and this tendency, but it's really across all of China.
And the Wall Street Journal, our fearless compatriots over on the news side, have managed to get into Xinjiang, which is just incredible, and are reporting that construction sites that they saw have doubled in size over the past year, in particular a site in Shul County. This is near Kashgar in the western part of the province. Hugo, they must be going in there at great risk because China controls the ability of foreign correspondents to travel very strictly. So I just found this reporting just absolutely remarkable.
Right. Some of this reporting is based on satellite photos, it has to be said. So they're saying that some of these camps are still expanding just within the last couple of weeks. Mm. There's been a substantial expansion of these camps. But the reporters are going into Xinjiang, have been in Xinjiang, trying to visit these camps. Of course, they're turned away, and interviewing people who have been confined to these camps, and their testimony is really appalling. So I think I'd urge people to go and look for this article, which on the web was published on August 17th, China's Uyghur camps swell as Beijing widens the dragnet. It's a really remarkable piece of reporting.
And it's important to talk about it. And I'm happy to report that at least the Trump administration has started to talk about it. Sam Brownback at the State Department, the ambassador for religious freedom, has talked about it. I would hope that we'd hear more of that language. Hugo, it's also disturbing, though, to see the sons and daughters, for instance, of those who have been interned speaking out, because to me that's a sign that it really is a desperate situation, because oftentimes if you speak to relatives or friends of those who have been quote-unquote disappeared in China, they don't talk to reporters unless the situation is very dire. It's almost the last resort.
Right. I think a lot of these people have nothing left to lose. Some of them have said, you know, I didn't talk before because I was afraid that my mother or other relatives would be interned. Now that all of them have been interned, there's nothing left to lose. They might as well speak out about it. Also, they've been interning the relatives of Uyghurs and other minorities overseas to try to intimidate them into not speaking out, including the relatives of reporters at Radio Free Asia.
It's so horrific.
Been one terrible case.
Free Asia, by the way, being a U.S. taxpayer-backed organization, so intimidating,
right, like
employees.
Voice of America,
yeah, intimidating Americans, essentially.
Right. So it's really appalling. The testimony, in particular, I would urge people to look at. They were saying in the camps, there's a quote from one former detainee saying, they would also tell us about religion, saying there's no such thing as religion. Why do you believe in religion? There is no God. So it's a scale of religious repression that, you know, is currently, I think, unparalleled in the world. I mean, there's really, where else is there an atheist regime outside of maybe North Korea that is trying to stamp out religion in this way?
Yeah, I can't think of one. We're going to continue to call attention to it. And again, kudos to our colleagues on the news side for this reporting. It's fantastic. And kudos, too, to the United Nations. And I don't do that very often. We don't compliment the UN very much on this podcast. But in this case, they are also starting to talk about it.
Yes, the UN was holding hearings about a week ago, hearing some of this testimony, and the Chinese were denying everything. That may have been what spurred them to make the admission that there were, in fact, these camps, although they called them vocational training centers.
Yeah, well, we'll continue to talk about it. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So on behalf of Hugo and me, Mary Kissel, thanks for listening to Foreign Edition, and please tweet to us at Hugo Restall and at Mary Kissel, all one word in both cases. We love your feedback. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Wednesday.